Puerto Rico's power play today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Most of Puerto Rico is still without power, and a small Montana firm is now in charge of rebuilding the island's grid.
You have a small, untested power company going in to help a desperate, bankrupt utility.
Doesn't sound like a recipe for success. Also, China's president pulls a Mao and gets himself written into the Communist Party's constitution. Translation?
Like Mao led the revolution, Xi Jinping is now preparing to lead China into a new era.
Plus, if you drink tea, it's probably imported, but farmers in South Carolina want to change that.
We had to first see, well, can we grow tea out here, and then will it make good tea?
Find out how they're doing today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on a Tuesday, or as they say across most of Puerto Rico, day 34 without power, following the devastation from Hurricane Maria. We've got a lot to get to today, but since we take our lights, our TVs, and our toasters for granted so often, let's kick off with the serious problems our fellow Americans are facing in Puerto Rico. Along with a deficit of clean water and trying to stay healthy in terrible hygienic conditions, it's the lack of electricity that's keeping all sorts of progress from happening on the island and has been for some time, says David Ferris.
Most of the power plants in Puerto Rico are more than 40 years old and were on their last legs before this storm hit. And so in order to restore power, even in San Juan, the capital, the power plants in that city are so weak that they can't do much of the repowering on their own.
Ferris is a reporter with the energy industry publication E&E News, and he was in Puerto Rico earlier this month. He's been telling us today about mutual aid agreements between utility companies in the U.S. When Florida had its blackout during Hurricane Irma, the local utility turned to another company in another state to help Floridians get back online. But Ferris says that PREPA, the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, didn't do that, and instead turned to a small energy company in Montana.
The head of PREPA, Ricardo Ramos, told me that he didn't want to turn to mutual aid agreements because PREPA couldn't afford it. The utility is $8 billion in debt. He said that it only had $100 million in emergency cash remaining, and those mutual aid agreements require repayment, and the money he had on hand would only support his operations for 2 months.
Yeah, so fiscal concerns, but is that unusual?
Highly unusual. I mean, the interesting thing is that Ramos and PREPA were in regular contact with the American Public Power Association. It's the Association for Municipal Utilities in the United States. He was in regular touch with them as Hurricane Irma came through and hit Puerto Rico earlier. And then he kind of went dark after Maria hit. He's claimed that he didn't get in touch with the mutual aid agencies because he actually couldn't make a phone call, even though he did place a phone call, for example, with Anderson Cooper of CNN immediately after the storm. And so did, as you said, instead turn to Whitefish, which is a company that until this all started had two employees, and it hired them for what's turned out to be $300 million to basically rebuild a major spine of the transmission system that will connect the southern part of the island where most of the power plants are to the northern part of the island in the area of San Juan where the capital is and where most of the power users are.
What do we know about Whitefish Energy, this contracting company in Montana? You said they've got two employees. What else do you know about them?
Whitefish's model, they say, is to be very small and light and to hire the crews they need to do what they need to do. It seems that they basically made an offer to PREPA saying, hey, we're here. We're available to do the work right before Maria hit. And they decided to hire them to do $300 million worth of work. And it seems that one of the prerequisites for that was that they didn't require any money up front. So you have a small, untested power company going in to help a desperate, bankrupt utility. And we simply don't know what that's going to look like or how long it's going to take.
Well, Whitefish Energy is also based in the hometown of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. Does this seem like a normal choice?
It's definitely not a normal choice. I don't know how much attention to pay or how much credence to put to the connection between Zinke and Whitefish Energy and the fact that they're from the same place. I mean, it's a suspect deal kind of regardless of where this company is coming from, but it's also from the Interior Secretary's very small hometown in Montana is really curious. There's starting to be some rumors, reports suggested in the Washington Post today, for example, that Congress is starting to look into these relationships.
So how do you see the work that Whitefish Energy and the Army Corps of Engineers are doing right now? Is it a short-term solution? If returning the Puerto Rican grid to its former state, does that kind of eclipse other projects like Tesla's proposal to create an entirely new kind of power grid?
Well, Donald Trump met with the governor of Puerto Rico last week, and he said that the U.S. is all in on rebuilding and improving the grid in Puerto Rico. I don't know whether that is in fact what's going to happen or whether that was just how he felt that day. But in order for that grid to be rebuilt in a new, cleaner, more robust and resilient way, it's going to require Congress. The way that the laws are set up and the way that the authority is granted to, for example, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, they actually have to rebuild it in exactly the way it stood before the storm came through. So Congress is going to have to pass some laws to make it better than it is now.
David Ferris, a reporter with E&E News, that's Environment and Energy. Thanks very much, David.
Thanks, Marco.
The Chinese Communist Party Congress. It happens once every 5 years, and we know what to expect. Obedience, loyalty, the party line, and occasionally some news is made, like today, when Chinese President Xi Jinping became more than he already is.
President of China, General Secretary of the Communist Party, Chairman of the Central Military Commission, and he is also designated as core leader of the Chinese Communist Party, which is a vague title, but it suggests considerable authority.
That's Chris Buckley, the New York Times China correspondent. He's been covering the Party Congress and spoke with us from Beijing about Xi Jinping's big political moment.
I think above all else, this Party Congress is going to be remembered for elevating Xi Jinping very much to the center of Chinese politics and suggesting that he's going to be a powerful presence in Chinese politics, certainly for the next 5 years and possibly beyond that.
Wow, some major confidence about the future. It's also interesting that Xi's name has now been enshrined in the Constitution. That would be the third leader in modern Chinese history, along with Mao and Deng, and now Xi. What is the significance of that?
Just to explain, this is the party constitution, so these are the rules for the Communist Party itself, and this is different from the state constitution, but this certainly has implications for the entire country. It doesn't have any direct political implications, but it adds to the halo of power and authority that Xi Jinping possesses. And as you were saying, it now puts him on a kind of the political pantheon there with Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping as well. It doesn't necessarily mean that he's as powerful as Mao, but it does suggest that he is seen as a transformative leader who, like Mao, led the revolution and Deng Xiaoping led China through reform and opening up. Party documents are now saying that Xi Jinping is now preparing to lead China into a new era, one which he dominates.
So will the public go along with that narrative that Xi is as great as Mao?
Public attitudes towards Xi Jinping and to Mao are quite complicated in China. I think what you find, especially outside of the big cities, is that many ordinary people, working people, welcome quite a few of Xi Jinping's policies over the past 5 years, especially the crackdown on corruption. That has been popular with many people here. That doesn't necessarily mean that people like all of Xi Jinping's policies, and it doesn't mean that they accept or like the idea of his being as strong as Mao. But he does have a strong basis of support in the country at large, and that's probably going to continue being so long as Xi Jinping can address the economic problems building up in China and ensure the economy keeps growing and the people's incomes keep growing.
I guess I should really ask you to look inside the party at its rank and file and what this means for them. I mean, during the party Congress, Xi was called absolute leader. And when asked for a show of hands by those not in favor of Xi, party members shouted none. So is that genuine? What kind of support does he have inside the party?
Over the past few years, there have been a number of policies introduced by Xi Jinping that you would think would be quite unpopular with many party members and officials. In particular, the crackdown on corruption has removed a lot of grey income, you could call it. Not necessarily kickbacks and outright bribes, but money that officials had access to before has certainly shrunk. And you can imagine that some of them would probably be grumbling about some of those policies. But in the current political environment in China, it's very difficult for that kind of grumbling to, first of all, to surface in the public, but also it's even more difficult for it to coalesce in some sort of organized or coherent opposition to Xi Jinping.
I'm curious, too, how much of the news from this party Congress is targeted kind of externally? Because one thing President Xi has done and continues to do is really portray himself as a responsible global leader. Do you see a connection?
I think so. This is primarily a domestic political show. There's no doubt about that. But certainly China is very much aware of its rising prominence in the world. And you could see that even in Xi Jinping's work report, which he gave to the Congress last week. There was a lot of emphasis in that report about China becoming a strong power or a great power. There is that awareness there, and I think it's going to become clearer after the Congress as well when the big propaganda push really takes off.
And from there in Beijing, Chris, does it feel like things in the U.S.-China relationship since Donald Trump moved into the White House in January, that things have changed in any really significant way?
We're going to find out about that in a couple of weeks when President Trump visits Beijing for the first time, at least for the first time as president. I think what you found with China's behavior towards Donald Trump is that they have learned to ignore the tweets. They just let these things ride out, and they focus very much on their interests, and they focus very much on trying to win over Donald Trump to their view of the world as well.
Chris Buckley of The New York Times speaking with us from Beijing. In China, there's little room for anybody who defies Xi's wishes or those of the Communist Party. My BBC colleague Carrie Gracie spoke with one person who's paid a price for speaking out, a women's rights activist in the city of Guangzhou.
24-year-old Lei Lei shows me video she filmed on her phone. In a dark lobby, an angry policeman forcing open the door of her flat.
He said, if you don't do what I said, I will arrest you.
Police harassment is a constant fear. She and her partner have been forced to move many times. No wonder they haven't bothered decorating here. The flat's as bare as a prison cell.
Whatever I do, they will harass me. They'll harass my landlords.
Do you think they see you as trouble?
Definitely, they see me as a rebel, someone who causes a lot of trouble, who don't behave, who don't just get a normal job.
What made Lei Lei a target was her campaign against sexual harassment on public transport. Elsewhere in the world, the Harvey Weinstein scandals exposed the scale of sexual harassment. But here, it's been dismissed by some as a Western problem. Campaigning forbidden. And Lei Lei's protest days are over. Xi Jinping's preferred politics on display at the Communist Party Congress in Beijing. A club where conformity is the code. Power runs top-down, not bottom-up. And the higher up the pyramid, the fewer women you see.
I think it's a general change in Chinese society that encourages women to go home, to be a wife, to be a mother, but not to be an independent woman, not to be a businesswoman, not to be a politician.
So for Lei Lei, there's nothing to cheer in the new era that the Communist Party is celebrating this week. Before Xi Jinping, the huge South China city of Guangzhou was a magnet, not just for feminists, but for lawyers, labor activists, and brave reporters. Like so many of them, Lei Lei now plans to leave China.
That's my colleague, the BBC's China editor, Carrie Gracie. Some visitors to the U.S. overstay their visas and become undocumented. How common is that? Find out still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Last year, more than 500,000 people overstayed their visas to the United States. That immediately puts them in legal limbo, and the Trump administration is pushing harder than ever to deport them. But is it really so cut and dried? Reporter Ashley Cleek has a story of one woman who came to the U.S. with her daughter and overstayed. And we should note that this story involves descriptions of abuse that some listeners might find disturbing.
The woman in this story asked not to be identified. I'll call her Sarah. She was hesitant to talk. She never shared her story publicly. At first, the main reason for overstaying her visa seemed straightforward. It was for her 2-year-old daughter.
My daughter is... she's beautiful. She's smart. She is autistic.
It was 2001. Sarah's from Granada, and she says services there for children with autism felt limited. Her daughter was born in America, so she's a U.S. citizen. Sarah isn't. but she knew there were better options in the U.S. Then, about 20 minutes into our interview, she tells me the other reason she went to the U.S. To escape her abusive husband.
I don't know if I should speak about the abuse, should I?
If you want to.
Oh, okay. I was undergoing a lot of abuse at the hands of my husband. I was pushed, urinated on. I must have heard the words, "You're stupid," so many times that I honestly believed it. I think one evening in particular, he drank. He had threatened to kill me. And I'm so sorry I get emotional. But he was very angry, just livid.
Sarah says that time was different because her infant daughter was in the room.
I'm not sure what happened, but for some reason, he stopped and he just walked out of the house, but he locked us in. So I just had the wherewithal to gather all my documents, passports, birth certificates, knowing that I have to escape this.
This was all happening as Sarah noticed something different about her newborn daughter. She decided that going to the U.S., leaving her husband and getting her child help was best. Sarah got a tourist visa, and in New York, her daughter was diagnosed with severe autism and started treatment.
And then I realized that my visa is about to run out. So I write to immigration and ask for an extension.
Sarah got a 6-month extension and then looked for a way to stay illegally. At the time, she didn't know there were possible options, like asylum, for women who flee domestic violence. Instead, she saw that visa expiration date closing in.
I felt helpless again because I felt as long as I had that visa, there was so much I could do.
With her visa running out, Sarah says she didn't know what to do. Her daughter was getting good treatment, and Sarah feared her husband in Granada. So she stayed.
Living here hasn't been easy. And the major reason for the difficulty is immigration. Because I cannot simply take a resume and present it to get a job. There's a deep sense of just stagnancy.
Right now, Sarah works under the table as an aide at an elementary school. But when school's out in the summer, it's hard for her to pay her bills. She relies on food pantries, food stamps the government gives her daughter, and on friends. For years, Sarah's also been working towards a BA in English at Hunter College in New York. She plans to graduate this year, but says since President Trump's election, her fear of being deported has increased.
And it's going down the checklist. And eventually it will get to me. That's my thought process. It's very scary.
Her daughter's now 18 and going to a school for autistic adults. Sarah spent about 15 years without any documentation. She recently applied for asylum based on the domestic abuse she suffered. Asylum isn't easy to get. More than half the people who try for it are denied. Sarah will appear before an immigration judge in January.
What a terrible position to be in. Reporter Ashley Clake joins me now. So that was the second of two stories that we've heard from you this week about people who came to the U.S. and overstayed their visas, Ashley. It's not a new trend, but there are new numbers coming from the Department of Homeland Security that are now helping us understand just how many people overstay. What are we seeing?
I mean, so first, it's really a big deal that we have these numbers. Last year was the first report in 2 decades. So we have numbers from last year and this year. And those numbers show that the rate of overstays is going up a little bit. Of like the 50 million people who get visas to the U.S. each year, about 630,000 people overstay, which is a pretty low rate. It's like 1.25%. But the thing is that now that we have the numbers, the thought is that this could be a group that the government would focus on in terms of immigration.
Do the numbers tell us anything about the people in this group, like where they primarily come from, who overstays? Is it students or tourists? What does that show?
So it's people from all over. Really, every country is represented. But the countries with the highest numbers of people who overstay are Canada, Mexico, Brazil, China, India, the UK, Germany, Colombia. So these are countries where citizens can get tourist and student visas to the US. And that's actually the thing that's the most interesting, is that the highest rate of overstays are students. So somebody who comes in with a student visa and either finishes school and overstays, or, you know, maybe doesn't finish school and just kind of tries to get a job and, you know, their visa expires.
Mm. What are the rules then? What happens if you overstay your visa, and what changes have we seen to those rules under Trump?
Yeah, it really depends on how long you overstay your visa. If you stay fewer than 180 days, you could be barred from coming back to the U.S. for up to 3 years. If you stay in the U.S. for more than a year after your visa's expired, you could be barred for up to 10 years, which is a pretty long time.
Right. And it occurs to me that the woman you introduced us to a moment ago, I mean, missing her renewal appointment, I mean, there's a lot at stake for her, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a lot. And, you know, she spent 15 years without any kind of status. So, you know, she missed asylum. You have to apply for asylum in the first year that you're here. So now she really has to make the case of, you know, why she missed that appointment. She has to give good reasons as to why she couldn't apply for asylum. And that's really difficult to do.
How harsh do you think life for people who overstay their visas could get under Trump?
I mean, it could get really harsh, right? And, you know, a lawyer that I spoke to in New York named Raymond LaHood, he said that he's heard from people that once their visa expires, immigration is contacting them or coming to their house, you know, that there's more focus on, you know, the day your visa expires that you leave the country. But there's no evidence that deportations are up or that there's really been any change under Trump so far.
So somebody like Sarah, the woman in your story earlier, Ashley, how concerned is she about how much more harsh things could get for people who overstay their visas?
I mean, she said she's really nervous. And she said, you know, the rhetoric around the election and then since the election has really made her very anxious. You know, she's anxious when she sees a police officer. She's anxious that if anyone ever asks for her documents, she doesn't have them. I think it's telling that it was really difficult to get people to go on the record about these stories. No one wants to come forward and say that they've overstayed at this point. No one wants to out themselves.
Reporter Ashley Clegg, thanks very much for breaking this all down for us.
Thanks so much, Marco.
We've got news headlines coming up in about 1 minute here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. 30 years ago, the killing of an Ethiopian man in Portland, Oregon, spurred activists to address racism and injustice. But two murders earlier this year showed residents there's much more work to be done.
But this is the story of America, isn't it? We've done this over and over and over again. This is not the first or the second or the third time.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. 5 months ago, two young black women, one of them wearing a hijab, were on a light rail train in Portland, Oregon. A white man began yelling insults at them. When two other white men intervened, the guy harassing the women stabbed and killed the two men. Media from across the world descended on Portland. A few months later, as things gradually calmed down, The World's Roopa Shenoy visited Portland. And she found a city still wrestling with its past.
It's hard to remember how shocking the Portland murders were, probably because so many horrible things have happened since. But what happened on the light rail was stunning in its cruelty.
A tirade on a train ends in horror.
The victims are being remembered as heroes.
They didn't even know me. And they lost their lives because of me and my friend and the way we looked.
Oh, I was heartbroken.
And Ayokende was just down the street in her office at a collection agency when it happened.
And to be taken that way was so, I don't know, so savage.
People called the light rail murders a wake-up call. But Portland's had wake-up calls before. Many of the city's older activists told me the murders made them remember their first wake-up call nearly 30 years ago and wonder if they'd done enough.
The crime took place here on Southeast 31st early Sunday morning. Three black men, all from Ethiopia, were sitting in this car talking. When one left to head for his apartment, another car pulled up. Three young white men jumped out and began beating him.
That time, Ndayo Kende was also just down the street.
I was in bed and sleeping. It was early in the morning.
Her young son was asleep, too, when someone knocked frantically. It was a guy who lived a few streets away, who Kende knew because they were both part of the same tiny, close-knit Ethiopian community in Portland. She followed him outside and saw a pool of blood in the street. He told her it was their friend Mulugeta's blood, Mulugeta Seurat. Kende pulled out old photo albums and showed me pictures of Seurat at their party.
This is him when we're in the community.
Seurat is serious and thin.
And
he looks so young.
He was very young.
He was 29, and he worked at a car rental place out at the airport. That night, Kende went to the hospital to find out what happened to him. They asked her to identify his body.
His head was blown, his whole body was blown up. It didn't feel real.
It took a while for Kende to realize that what happened to Seurat had a particular significance in America because he was black, and the people who killed him were members of the white Aryan nation.
Yeah, losing Mulugeta was sad, but when it got big like that, it was something unexpected.
There were anti-hate protests and rallies and speeches and community meetings. Mulugeta Seurat became a symbol for people who identified with him, like Scott Nakagawa.
It felt incredibly personal to me. I felt immediately as if I was in danger.
Nakagawa was a young college dropout from Hawaii of Japanese descent. He worked at a homeless nonprofit and had been chased home by a truckload of white men who pummeled him with beer cans.
Portland police said there were no neo-Nazi skinhead groups here, and we saw them. They were, you know, in our faces.
Nakagawa joined a ragtag band of young activists who, by night, infiltrated Portland's blossoming punk rock scene where white supremacist groups were trying to recruit. By day, they organized out of an old warehouse they called the Matrix. There were squatters living in one corner, and in another, an old printing press once used by Portland radicals.
There was an incident once when a small group of neo-Nazi skinheads came to our door and then started to try to chop it down with pickaxes. And the amount of panic inside the building was just comical. You know, I mean, all the men, myself included, were running around looking for something. When did they come in here? What do? We need to pick up a club. We need to find a baseball bat. We need to do something. But they were stopped by one young woman who had the presence of mind to simply open the second-story window and point her camera out. And when they realized their pictures were being taken, they ran away.
They were all just silly kids, Nakagawa says. But they were part of an unprecedented network of Portland groups that called itself the Coalition to Protect Human Dignity. Together, they amassed evidence, like white supremacist newsletters and magazines, to prove to police that white hate groups were a threat. What remains of those archives is now kept at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education. Steve Wasserstrom, a Coalition for Human Dignity board member, showed them to me and Scott Nakagawa. It was the first time Nakagawa was seeing the material in decades.
Oh, it brings back a lot of memories.
It makes me feel old.
This is a free music magazine. And what you can see here is the Charlie Manson with a swastika on his head spewing blood.
Wasserstrom was a Jewish studies professor and one of the coalition's public faces. White supremacist leaders published his name and address. And Wasserstrom got graphic, violent threats. He went to the police and an officer advised him to get a dog.
I'm supposed to go home and tell my wife with these two small children that these Nazis have threatened us. They know where we live. I'm a public figure, and I should get a dog. So, yeah, that didn't feel like it made me much more secure.
When we would call the police, they would often take a long time to show up, you know. I think because they just felt like these are just sort of people who are just trying to look for a fight, you know. I think briefly we were regarded, some of us, as gang members, you know, anti-racist gang members.
Police don't remember it like that. When I asked what it was like back then, Sergeant Chris Burley, Portland Police Public Information Officer, called the detective who investigated Seurat's murder for a firsthand account.
The city recognized that there was an immediate issue that was coming about involving hate groups.
From the police point of view, there was an overwhelming response. Oregon passed a landmark hate crime statute. Police found Seurat's killers, and the men were convicted. Then, the founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, Alabama civil rights attorney Morris Dees, came to town with a novel new strategy to drain resources from hate groups by suing them. Dees sued California KKK Grand Dragon Tom Metzger, arguing Metzger incited the men who killed Seurat. Dees won, and Metzger was ordered to pay $12 million, at the time the most ever awarded in a hate case. Burley says during the trial, police protected the judge, jury, and Seurat's family 24 hours a day.
And recognizing that there was a likelihood that other hate groups could come to support those that had killed Mr. Seurat.
But as for tracking white hate groups in general, Burley says police can only investigate if a crime's been committed, so the Bureau couldn't always do what activists wanted.
As law enforcement officials, we might find the words offensive, but so much of the time what people say is protected by the First Amendment.
Things changed suddenly in 1994 when Timothy McVeigh bombed the Oklahoma City Federal Building. The FBI made white hate groups a priority. Nakagawa says within a decade, there was the perception the problem had been addressed. Funding for anti-hate groups slowed. The Coalition for Human Dignity collapsed. Nakagawa and other activists moved on to other organizations and other causes. Fast forward to May 25th, earlier this year. An African-American woman named Demetria Hester was on the light rail, going home from her job as a chef. A white man started yelling racial slurs. She asked him to stop, and he threatened her. Hester later told her story at a press conference.
It was 25 to 50 people on that train that did nothing.
She got off the train. The man followed her and allegedly hit her in the eye with a Gatorade bottle. Hester maced him. She told a police officer what happened, but the officer couldn't find the man who'd threatened her. That man turned out to be Jeremy Christian, the same man who, allegedly, the very next day, got on the same train line and committed the murders that put a national spotlight on Portland.
I should feel safe in Portland. I don't.
Looking back, Scott Nakagawa thinks what he and other activists did after Mulugeta Seraa's murder was important and had an impact. But he says they failed to be vigilant. And now it feels like they're starting from scratch.
We should have been more attentive. But this is the story of America, isn't it? We've done this over and over and over again. This is not the first or the second or the third time.
Tomorrow, we look at Portland's response to its most recent wake-up call. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy in Portland.
We're going to spend the next few minutes talking about emoluments. Obscure word, I know. Well, it was until this year. An emolument is an old-fashioned term to describe a gift or a favor, as in the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. Author Sarah Chase knows all about it. In fact, she had firsthand experience of what that clause is designed to prevent. Back in 1991, as a Pentagon employee, Chase accompanied then-chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, on a visit to Kuwait.
We got back on the plane, and there's this stack of, you know, beautiful leather-coated black spring hinge boxes, and each one had the name of a member of the traveling party on it. And so I took my box and opened it up, and, you know, my eyes popped out because there was a very nice Rolex watch in that box.
Wow.
And I remember closing the box and putting it back on the stack because the rule is, and this is the law, above a certain trivial amount, you have to buy it back if you want it. And I watched Admiral Mullen give back tons of gifts that he had been offered in his official capacity, and it becomes the property of the United States government.
The Emoluments Clause applies to anyone in government, and it covers more than just Rolexes. Ever since President Trump assumed office, concerns have been growing that he is violating the Emoluments Clause by using the presidency to boost his businesses. Just days after Trump was inaugurated, a watchdog group called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington filed a lawsuit alleging that the president was exploiting the presidency for his personal profit. That case opened last week in federal district court in New York. Sarah Chase filed a friend of the court brief in support of the lawsuit, and I asked her to begin by telling me what the suit is all about.
It alleges that by not separating himself from the Trump Organization, President Trump is receiving fees, profits, and other items of value from foreign governments or foreign officials, right, when they stay either in hotels or the club in Florida, or as the Trump Organization continues to push forward with its projects overseas.
So explain how this matters to Americans. How do the president's foreign business entanglements actually pose some kind of threat here?
The framers of the Constitution were really obsessed with government corruption. They were really concerned specifically that public officials should only answer to the interests of the citizens, you know, that they are either appointed or elected to serve. So if the president is taking items of value or any public official is taking items of value from a foreign government, the first concern is that, well, what's their decision-making going to be? Which interests will they be serving when they actually have to make government decisions? And, you know, social science recently is showing that even gifts that are genuinely given without any expectation of return favor, you know, it engenders a sense of gratitude. I think the second threat is even, to me, more dangerous.
And what's that?
Which is, we are the only country on the planet, right, that was established explicitly to kind of embody a set of ideals. Now, I get it that we haven't, right? I mean, that there's been a gap, obviously, throughout our history between what we claim we are and what we've actually been. But that is our reason to exist. That's why we are a nation. And if the types of business practices that are common in the countries where the Trump Organization does business, if that becomes sort of normalized, I really think it's a threat to American democracy. I looked at half a dozen countries where the Trump Organization has, you know, big complexes and clubs and things like that. And every one of them counts as what I would call a kleptocracy, meaning, you know, corruption exists everywhere. These are countries where it's the almost the operating principle of how the government works.
What should, what can Americans do about this?
You know, it's interesting. Around the world, there has been an outpouring of indignation about corruption from Brazil and Guatemala in this hemisphere to Burkina Faso and South Africa and Africa to Romania to Lebanon. It's really remarkable. And in a way, the anti-corruption rhetoric of our electoral campaign shows that Americans are in step with this zeitgeist. And so what I'm seeing overseas are a couple of things. One is the people have to get involved. So if people who are listening to us have been activated by concerns about healthcare or concerns about some of the environmental things that might be happening in their region, in a way, this issue almost underlies it all. This overlap between private interest and public office is what's driving a lot of these other issues. And yet I didn't see people protesting in front of Trump hotels when the emoluments hearing opened. So I really think Americans need to get into this game. Second point is we all have to avoid the temptation to turn this into a partisan issue. This is about our system. And that means we all have to be really tough on our own side, as well as pointing fingers at the other side. So Americans have to resist the temptation to obsess about a single individual and instead think about the institutional weaknesses that have allowed that individual and his network to do what they've done. And it's those institutional weaknesses, it's an institutional reform that we all have to have the stamina to demand even after this individual is out of office.
Sarah Chase, Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Her latest book is Thieves of State. Thanks very much for being with us today, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Over to our 50 States project now. It's our ongoing look at how globalization is impacting communities across the United States. Today, we're giving a shout out to Steve Lorch, who listens to The World on South Carolina Public Radio's WEPR. He wrote in and told us to talk about growing tea, not in India, Sri Lanka, China, or Kenya, but in his adopted hometown of Pickens, South Carolina, a small, economically depressed Appalachian town. Here's The World's Jason Margolis.
Steve Lorch is a surgical nurse. His other job is running a tea farm. His company, Table Rock Tea, began innocently enough with one plant. He had started a clean water project in Kenya, where he fell in love with all things tea.
So I came home and bought a plant online and stuck it in our backyard in our subdivision where we were living. And it happened to grow, and this is actually that plant. We call this one Big Daddy, and this is the one that sort of started the whole thing.
He and his wife moved to the countryside, then decided to grow a hedge made from tea plants.
By the time we got up to about 400 or 500, we started thinking, well, how much does this produce every year? Why don't we just start a tea company?
Lorch and his wife are now 4 years into their business plan. He says that's the rocky phase, the proof of concept.
We had to first see, well, can we grow tea out here? And then is it reproducible? And then will it make good tea? because if any of those answers were no, there was no reason to expand into a commercial greenhouse and all that kind of stuff.
All signs pointed to yes, so the expansion was on.
Oh, this is our handy-dandy Cushman golf cart that we use for work around the farm, but we also give tours in it, too, so hang on.
Lorch took me on a ride around the property.
It's 17 acres. Eventually, we'll expand to 30, and there's no telling how far we'll expand when the consortium goes full blast.
The consortium is other locals. Lorch's vision is to sell young plants to his neighbors. They'll harvest them, then sell the tea leaves back to Lorch. Right now, he has six neighbors on board. In 30 years, though, he'd like upstate South Carolina to be to American-grown tea what Napa is to American wine. This might sound wildly optimistic, but is it? Let's turn to James Norwood Pratt in San Francisco, author of many books about tea. I asked him, where are the world's finest teas grown today? I was looking for a geographic answer. That's not what Pratt offered.
The world's best tea, Jason, is grown where people take the most care of the plant and its leaf in regions that are particularly favorable to that plant's growth. And so it could quite possibly come from Pickens, South Carolina.
Pouring his own cup, Pratt says growing quality tea takes three basic things.
You need, Jason, heaven, earth, and man.
You need the right soils, climate, and knowledgeable people to produce great tea. If they can pull this off in Pickens, South Carolina, Patrick Lark would love it. He's president of the Pickens Revitalization Association. Pickens has a familiar Appalachian small town story, a place that got left behind as work shifted to cheaper foreign labor.
This area was just so entrenched with textiles for years that that just kind of left a void here.
Lark is from Pickens. He's 40 now and calls Pickens an ideal place to grow up, a storybook small town. You want to know how small? During our interview, a truck rolled by outside, and without turning to look, Lark said, "That's Danny Adams."
Is one of the guys that lives towards the end of town, and I know he was coming to check on his parents who lived down the street from the chamber office here.
How would you know it was his truck?
Just by the sound. It's a small town.
Pickens seems like a nice place, but it needs jobs. I asked Lark if he really thinks his town could become the next great tea spot, and along with that, bring employment.
It's one of those things that off the cuff, you just kind of scratch your head and go, well, how's this going to work? And then you go meet with Steve and see what he's got going on, and you just can't help but buy in.
Back in his garage, Lorch shows off what he calls his microfactory. A machine separates dried leaves, then heat seals them into tea bags. The garage is filled with cool-looking machines. Because there's not much of a tea industry in the U.S., it can be hard to find the right equipment. So the Lorches had to get creative.
My wife used to work at Subway Subs, and she said, hey, that's just a proofing oven.
It's now their tea oxidizer.
Yeah. In fact, if you look on the back, it says Subway.
No question, Lorch is facing a lot of challenges. He knows it. His biggest challenge, though, may not be growing the right leaves or processing them just right. It's the basic economics.
My statistics might be a little bit off on this, but last I had checked, I think a Sri Lankan picker gets about $3 to $5 a day.
There's just no way Lorch can compete with that. So he'll have to grow better tea and charge more for it. His long-term strategy includes exporting to the world's great tea countries.
Someone in China who's looking for a rare tea would find it in a U.S.-grown tea.
Who knows? His boxes labeled Hillbilly, America's native tea, with a cartoon of a guy and his dog moonshining tea, that just might sound exotic to someone halfway around the world. I did some informal polling of British, Chinese, and Sri Lankan tea drinkers and asked if they'd buy tea from South Carolina. One Sri Lankan responded via email, ha ha, ha ha ha. I also called the Chinese tea company in London and spoke with founder Juan Webster. She says Chinese teas are the best, but she thinks Chinese consumers might give South Carolina a chance.
It's hard to say. I think for people who are willing to try, see what flavor like. I think Chinese is quite open to that.
But the brand name Hillbilly, that didn't register.
No idea. Hillbilly. How do you spell?
H-I-L-L-B-I-L-L. So perhaps not a selling point, at least not yet. Still, Steve Lorch is just getting started. And if he can create an extraordinary tea, and he believes he can, maybe the sales and the jobs will follow. For The World, Jason Margolis, Pickens, South Carolina.
If you want to be part of our 50 states coverage or have an idea for a story, visit us at pri.org/50states. That's 50 states. We read all of your notes and we might come visit. Seriously. Remember, we heard about Pickens and Table Rock Tea because Steve Lorch is a listener and he wrote in. Trippy stuff, right? Call it 50 altered states. Anyway, this is the Kun Narin Electric Fin Band from Thailand. If you search mind-blowing psychedelia from Thailand on YouTube, you'll find the band under a tree outside the city of Lom Sak performing this. It was that video that got them international attention, and now the Kun Narin Electric Fin Band have an album. That's just the way the world works, people. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.